Welcome to the Inside Elections podcast, where we analyze elections in a nonpartisan, data-driven, and accessible way. In this episode, we'll talk about how the State of the Union speech and Republican response will impact congressional races. We'll dive into key primaries from Super Tuesday that will decide the House and Senate majorities. We'll identify a handful of candidates who look like they are already headed to Congress next year. And we've got help from special guest Mary Ellen McIntyre of Roll Call. Buckle up. I'm Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections, the go-to place for nonpartisan analysis for more than 40 years. I just got back from the National PAC Conference in Fort Lauderdale, which is in Florida's 23rd district, represented by Democrat Jared Moskowitz.
I'm Jacob Rubashkin, deputy editor of Inside Elections, and I just got back from an arduous trek across the Potomac River to Virginia's 8th district, represented by Don Beyer, Democrat, where I was giving a speech to some of our subscribers.
And I want to welcome our special guest, Mary Ellen McIntyre, political reporter for Roll Call. Mel, welcome.
Hey, good to be here.
And you have to answer our question of what congressional district did you grow up in?
I grew up in New Hampshire's 1st District, which is currently represented by Chris Pappas, who I first knew of his family because they run a restaurant that has the region's best chicken tenders. They are always a hit and a crowd pleaser. But I think before that, it was probably best known for being the district that flipped every 2 years between Carol Shea Porter and Frank Ginta for about a decade.
Yeah, that was crazy. And then Ginta got into some, well, through that, I think Ginta got into some hot water with campaign finance, and it was quite a ride, I guess.
It was indeed.
And what was life like in New Hampshire growing up?
I think I thought that presidential candidates just went to everyone's hometown. when I went to college at George Washington University here in DC, and I remember being like, I think it was my freshman year. It was, you know, gearing up for the 2012 presidential election. And I was like, oh yeah, like Obama's going to my hometown today. And everyone was like, wait, what? And I was like, oh, that doesn't happen everywhere. So you definitely have a reflected sense of self-importance in the U.S. political system that you just kind of grow up thinking is normal.
Yeah, that's pretty great. That's pretty great.
Mel, is this the restaurant that claims to have invented the chicken finger? Is this?
Maybe. I don't know enough about the restaurant's history to know if they claim to have invented the chicken finger.
When I wrote my Nepo Babies of the House of Representatives story, there was a member who had a familial connection to the invention of the chicken finger. Yes, Chris Pappas's grandfather is credited with inventing the chicken the chicken tender. I'll be specific.
Yes, very specific chicken tender.
Yes, the chicken tender from the Pappas family. So there you go.
When my parents host like big family parties or anything, they get just like a huge bin of these chicken tenders. And I feel like in the days after the party, when I'm home, I'll just like walk by the fridge and like grab one throughout the day. They're very, very addicting.
Well, look, I'm already learning stuff in this episode. I hope everyone else is learning something from this episode, too. You never know what you're going to get with the Inside Elections podcast. But we've got a lot to cover. So let's get started. We usually do some headlines before our main topics, but last night was the State of the Union. Here's a clip from President Joe Biden.
In November, my team began serious negotiations with a bipartisan group of senators. The result was a bipartisan bill with the toughest set of border security reforms we've ever seen. Oh, you don't think so? Oh, you don't like that bill, huh? That conservatives got together and said it was a good bill? I'll be darned. That's amazing. I would respectfully suggest my Republican friends owe it to the American people, get this bill done. We need to act now.
And here's a clip from the GOP response given by Senator Katie Britt of Alabama.
Right now, our commander-in-chief is not in command. The free world deserves better than a dithering and diminished leader. America deserves leaders who recognize that secure borders, stable prices, safe streets, and a strong defense are actually the cornerstones of a great nation. Just ask yourself, are you better off now than you were 3 years ago?
Jacob, so what did you hear last night that could impact congressional elections all the way in November?
Oh, gosh. I mean, we're still 8 months out from the election. I'm not sure that anything specific that Biden said last night is going to be a major piece of the elections. I think that it was clear that Democrats want to go on offense over immigration, and particularly the bill, the bipartisan bill that got shot down in the Senate. And you know, that was one of the most raucous moments of the night when Biden was going back and forth with the House Republicans. I think we learned a lot about kind of the focus that Democrats have or want to have and which issues heading into November. Honestly, I think the biggest takeaway from this is that Biden was really fired up. And that's something that I know a lot of Democrats have been wanting to see from him pretty desperately for quite some time. And so the fact that he got up there, that he delivered, I believe, a 68-minute speech, that he had some verbal stumbles, but he, you know, that's to be expected. But he took it to Republicans. He got into those back and forths with them. I think Democrats have to be very pleased. And to the extent that Republicans are putting a lot of their eggs in the Biden is senile basket, I mean, that's a tough game to play because it's a bar that he shows he can clear pretty easily whenever he actually has the national spotlight on him, like in the situation last night.
Right. And a bar that Republicans continue to lower with those attacks, right? Mel, what did you see or hear last night that you think could, you know, be a factor all the way to November?
I think I agree with Jacob in that it's hard to say that there's like one thing from the speech, but I do think in looking at how Democrats are very, very pleased with how Biden came out, I think that one thing you could see from it is if House members, down ballot candidates feel more comfortable saying that they'll appear with Biden on the campaign trail. I think, you know, one of the things that I'm always looking at in how the presidential race affects down ballot races is, do candidates want to tie themselves to this candidate? And I think that Democrats are feeling really good about Joe Biden right now and will probably feel better about, okay, if he comes to my district, he's not going to be this bumbling old man. He's going to, you know, have it on and feel comfortable saying, yes, I'll appear with him on the campaign trail. One other thing that I thought was sort of interesting was his decision to, out of the gate, start with Ukraine as opposed to more domestic issues. You know, those, some of the more kitchen table types are maybe weaker policy issues for Democrats right now. You know, a lot of people, despite the economy appearing to get better, don't feel great about prices. That's something that Republicans are really trying to focus on. So coming out of the gate with Ukraine and foreign policy, I thought was an interesting choice. I don't know how much that'll affect, you know, the down ballot races, but interesting choice on his part.
Yeah, and some Republicans were complaining that he didn't touch the border or immigration until much farther, you know, into the speech of probably 45 plus minutes in, and that's right. But Republicans were going to hate this speech anyway. There wasn't anything that Biden was going to do that Republicans are, oh man, I was against Biden and now I'm for him. Of course, they're going to criticize him for being political. I mean, come on, like this is craziness that is one of the chief attacks on this speech from Republicans.
Mel, to your point, for those of us who are watching the C-SPAN feed, which I would always highly recommend when it comes to these events, Biden worked the floor for about 30 minutes or longer after the speech was done. And there was a C-SPAN camera that was basically following him throughout the entire thing, picking up much of his conversations with Democratic members, which I honestly thought was the most fascinating part of the evening, just because it's so unscripted and you really get to see Biden in his element. To your point about the question of whether House Democrats will want to campaign with him. The cameras picked up an interesting conversation between Biden and Michigan Congresswoman Hillary Scolton, who represents Western Michigan. And she came up to him and she said, "Mr. President, Michigan loves you. We want to have you out there as often as you want." And so I thought, obviously, her district is kind of at the periphery of the battlefield. Biden would have won it by, I want to say, about 8 points in the 2020 election. So it's not perhaps the most swingy of seats, but it's still a historically Republican area. And Michigan, obviously, host to at least two, if not three or four, highly competitive congressional races, a highly competitive Senate race, and that presidential contest. So clearly, at least some Democrats were fired up enough to be rolling out the red carpet for Biden as we head into the fall.
Yeah, I think that was one of the key that Democrats, Biden has been taking on a lot of water lately. He's an unpopular incumbent. I think Democrats needed this as a shot in the arm. And it was not only how he delivered the speech, but that he gave a roadmap on specific issues, right? We're going to talk about democracy, abortion access, the economy, access to school, you know, affordable schools, taxes, healthcare, prescription drugs. I mean, he went through the list. And so I want to spend just a second on the Republican response. When Katie, Senator Britt showed up on the screen for the response, I was like, oh, Biden is in trouble. Like, Democrats are in trouble. And then as she went along, like, okay, this was the delivery, probably right messenger, delivery, execution was not as great. But Mel, what did you think about Senator Britt's response?
You know, I think Senator Britt was a really good choice for Republicans who are, you know, trying to draw a contrast with President Biden by choosing the youngest female senator, a mom of two school-aged kids. And she comes across very well, usually. Something about her delivery last night really took away from her message and what she was trying to say, which I think the content of her speech was things that Republicans probably would have really resonated with. But that speech, you know, we've seen a lot of different people give that speech, and mostly the takeaways are unrelated to what they say. This was another example of just how the performance itself was not necessarily a winning one for her on a night that, you know, I saw some people this morning on our favorite platform, twitter.com, saying, you know, there was a video that she had posted earlier in the day of just sort of like, hey, I'm about to give the Republican speech, like, tune in. And it was like, why didn't you just talk like this? So right. Don't right. Exactly know why, but.
Where to begin?
We still have more races to cover in this podcast.
We still have more races to cover. No, look, I think that this is, it's like being on the cover of Madden, right? Delivering the response to the State of the Union is a thankless job. I don't understand why they continue to give it to their up-and-comers as opposed to perhaps their over-the-hill, more over-the-hill members who have less to lose. It's difficult to remember someone who delivered a well-received State of the Union response. Someone on Twitter floated Bob McDonnell, the former Virginia governor, in 2010. And he made, I think, the right decision of delivering it in front of a packed legislative chamber. He had applause. He had, you know, military officers in uniform sitting behind him. He was able to try and respond to the gravitas of the State of the Union with a little gravitas of his own. But no, look, I think that it's really telling this morning that there are no clips of this speech being pushed out by Republicans. The Senate Republican Twitter account has been tweeting out these graphics of quotes with unrelated photos of Senator Britt attached to them, but no clips of the video. I think that in the grand scheme of things, it probably doesn't matter all too much. I mean, people still make jokes about Marco Rubio's water sip or, you know, Bobby Jindal's performance in this speech a couple years ago, but that's very inside the beltway. I don't think this has much of an impact one way or another on the election or Senator Britt's future.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say about the speech is that we have to wait at least a couple of weeks to see if this makes an immediate impact, right? We have to see, let the coverage sink in a little bit, let people digest it, let pollsters go into the field to ask people what they thought about, you know, and has it changed their opinion on the job President Biden is doing, and then we'll get some results. So I'm not expecting a huge bump. I think we're a very partisan country, but it's still going to be a few weeks before we'll get empirical data on what people thought about the speech. So, but let's move on. Beyond the presidential race, there were at least 24 consequential House primaries on Super Tuesday. Let's start with a batch of primaries that set the stage for competitive general elections in November. I want to start in North Carolina in the 1st District. We know now that Democratic Congressman Don Davis, who's running in a newly drawn district that Republicans drew to try to defeat him, will face a retired U.S. Army Colonel Lori Buckout. Mel, what's key about this race moving forward?
Well, looking at this race, this district, it's going to be the only competitive House race in North Carolina this year after redistricting. So big swing state, only competitive congressional race that they've got going on this cycle. And Republicans got their preferred candidate, Lori Buckout, in this primary win. She defeated Sandy Smith, who lost to Don Davis 2 years ago. She lost a congressional race 4 years ago as well. She's got some personal baggage with some domestic violence allegations that she denies, but you know, these are things that have been out there for a while, would have been easy for Democrats to tie to. Lori Buckout, on the other hand, she's a new face, a political newcomer. So while there will be the challenges that come along with that, Republicans are hoping that she can give them, you know, a fresh start, somebody that is conservative, but not quite as much from the MAGA wing of the party. She, you know, still had support from, I believe it was SBA list, one of the abortion groups, the Congressional Leadership Fund. So she's not like a moderate by any means. Like, you know, I don't necessarily think she's out here campaigning as like, I'm going to be, you know, one of those like New York Republicans, but she's a bit more of a, what's the right word? Like polished conservative, I suppose you could say, running in this race, trying to flip this seat.
Yeah, not as provocative, maybe, yes, as some other Republicans. And this is a district that Biden won with just barely over 50% in 2020. So there's no guarantee he's going to win it again. We have it rated as toss-up at Inside Elections. It's kind of inland, northeastern part of the state. Yeah, but this is at the center, you know, at the center of the House battleground. Jacob, I want to move to California because there are a bunch of races there. Let me run through the ones that and some of them are uncalled, but we know the direction. In the 22nd district, in the Southern Central Valley, Eastern Bakersfield, it looks like Congressman David Valadao, the Republican, will have a rematch with Democrat Rudy Salas. Down in Orange County, there are a few districts. In the 40th district, it looks like Young Kim will face Joe Kerr. In the 45th district, also Orange County, Michelle Steele. It's uncalled, but Democrat Derek Tran is leading in that race. 47th district, this is the Katie Porter, open Katie Porter seat. It's officially uncalled, but it looks like Republican Scott Baugh against Democrat Dave Minn. Moving further south towards San Diego, Democratic Congressman Mike Levin against Republican Matt Gunderson. And then over in Riverside, out to Palm Desert, is Republican Congressman Ken Calvert in a rematch with Democrat Will Rollins. So Jacob, pick from those, pick which I know it's like choosing favorites here, but what stood out to you about those big races?
A lot to cover there. Obviously the 22nd district Democrats avoided disaster there. This was a race that saw millions in outside spending for both parties as they were determined to get their favored candidates, Rudy Salas for Democrats, David Valadao for Republicans, across the finish line when there were underfunded, weaker contenders from both parties, Chris Mathis on the Republican side, Melissa Hurtado on the Democratic side, that were threatening to finish in the top two. So both parties got what they wanted out of the 22nd, but it came with a cost. You know, I think that the other one that stood out to me is in that Katie Porter seat, Congressman Porter finishing third in that Senate race, leaving this seat open. This race became, I would argue, one of the nastiest, if not the nastiest, Democratic primary, House primary on the map. And there was a ton of outside money spent in the final 2 months of the race against Dave Min, the state senator who had Porter's endorsement, but whose campaign has been dogged by a DUI that he got last year. The AIPAC-affiliated group United Democracy Project came in and spent, I want to say the final total was probably pushing $5 million against Min, largely negative advertising about the DUI, and it did not work. Min still finished several points, I think like 8 points ahead of the next closest Democratic challenger, Joanna Weiss, who's an attorney and activist. So I think that Republicans are very eager to make hay about Min's DUI. The communications director for the NRCC tweeted out a couple days ago that the 47th district would be bathed in blue and red lights for the next 8 months, referring, of course, to the blue and red police lights that dominate the video of Min being pulled over last year. But I think that what these results showed is that at least some voters are not necessarily receptive to that argument. I mean, we saw a lot of spending focused on this issue, and it did not drag Min down. And so I think Republicans obviously have an opening there. It's a real offensive opportunity for them. But if this really were a devastating blow to Min's campaign, he wouldn't be the nominee.
Right. And I don't know if we've said yet, the Republican candidate or nominee, it's a top two primary, but it will be Scott Baugh, who lost to Katie Porter last time. But Katie Porter dramatically outspent Scott Baugh in last cycle's race. This cycle, Dave Min, along with the challenges that you've laid out, has also not been a great fundraiser. Joanna Weiss, the other Democrat in the race, was running circles around him in fundraising. And so this is going to be a race that Democrats are going to have to spend resources in, I think, helping him. But Mel, what stood out, either an individual race or kind of big picture looking at the California races?
I think big picture, California is one of the states that Democrats are really relying on, along with New York, where they really see a possibility to flip back control here. And I think it seems like, for the most part, you know, they got candidates that they're happy with. So they are going to be, you know, charging ahead here. I think if we want to look at the Senate race as well, there's been a lot of debate in the last couple of days about will having a Democrat, Adam Schiff, facing Republican Steve Garvey, as opposed to him facing another Democrat, Katie Porter, is that going to, you know, tamp down interest in House races? Is that going to, you know, pull fewer Democrats out to vote in House races in California this year? I think that's a bit of a stretch of an argument, especially in a presidential year. You know, if it was a midterm, maybe it'd be a different story. But I think, you know, we're going to have a lot of very competitive contests in this state, and Democrats seem to have gotten, for the most part, or about to get, because California is one of the slowest vote counting states in the country, the candidates they want.
Yeah. And I was going to talk about the Senate race later, but let's talk about it now because you brought it up. One of the things that stood out to me that I think has to be said is that Katie Porter, who finished third, as Jacob, as you mentioned, talked about the election. She was complaining about being outspent by Adam Schiff, complaining that he used some of his money to put Steve Garvey in his ads to boost Garvey, help Garvey consolidate Republican support. She's obviously frustrated by that, but she called it, so, you know, people wanting to rig the election. And outspending a candidate is not rigging an election, or boosting a candidate, a Democrat boosting a Republican candidate is not rigging an election. So I know she's received some criticism from other Democrats who have said, you know, that's not language or a word that we should be using in that way. But Jacob, what stood out to you about the Senate race?
I think that we should be able to have conversations about the outsized role of money in politics and the political gamesmanship that the top two primary invites, perhaps without using such inflammatory language, but I think that letting aside the specific use of the word rigged, I think it's a legitimate gripe that Katie Porter was making that this was politics. This was, it wasn't anything new for California, certainly, but I think that it's a legitimate conversation to have about what we want our elections to look like. Obviously, there was nothing fraudulent, there was nothing illegal, you know, clearly this was something that I think she has legitimate frustrations about, even though I think she also misplayed her hand in some ways that didn't help her. No, I think that Schiff ultimately played a pretty masterful game. He was able to do so because he raised $32 million, which is enough to run two campaigns, which is essentially what he did. He ran his own campaign and he ran Steve Garvey's campaign. But to Mel's point about whether this will have an outsized impact on House races down ballot, I remain very, very skeptical. I struggle to see who the Republican is who is going to show up for Steve Garvey, who wasn't already going to show up for Donald Trump. And I am also skeptical of who the Democrat is who's going to stay home because they don't get to vote for Katie Porter or Adam Schiff against Katie Porter, who wasn't already going to stay home or who doesn't want to come out and vote against Donald Trump in the presidential election. I think presidential elections drive turnout. Senate races, especially in a state like California. Gosh, I mean, what percentage of Californians do you think even know who the two candidates in the Senate race are at this point? Less than you would think. Yeah. Whatever you're thinking, subtract a couple points off of it. So I don't buy that theory at all.
Well, the other Senate primary with that we were looking at on Super Tuesday was in Texas, where Democratic Congressman Colin Allred won the nomination. Maybe more surprisingly, he avoided a runoff, which was certainly a possibility. And so, but now he gets to focus completely on Republican Senator Ted Cruz. We have this race rated as likely Republican, so it's sort of barely on the Senate battlefield. It's the most vulnerable seat that we have for Republicans, and that's barely on the list. Democrats are going to work to make it more competitive. But I don't know if either of you had quick thoughts on Texas.
I think just avoiding the runoff is big for Allred. You know, he's had to spend a bit more in the primary than maybe he would have preferred to. So to avoid having to spend specifically more on a runoff is good for him. It's good for Democrats' Senate agenda more broadly, just to have more time to try to make this a competitive race. Senate Democrats really, really want to be able to go on offense here. I think we will see in the coming months how successful they can be in trying to push this into like that sort of middle tier of competitive Senate races that we're seeing this year. But time will tell. I mean, Texas has been a big goal for Democrats for the last several cycles. We'll see if this is the year that they can try to make that realistic or not.
There was also a batch of Republican primaries in which the primary is essentially choosing the next member of Congress because the general election is a formality in a solidly Republican district. One of the big races was in Alabama, where you had two incumbents running against each other. Congressman Barry Moore defeated Congressman Jerry Carl. And so the first thing, Carl is the first incumbent to lose, but I just want to say, be on the record, and that does not mean we have an anti-incumbent election or this string going through. This was a newly drawn district, and that is what put Carl in danger, even though he represented more of the district than Barry Moore, but there were a lot of dynamics there. But let me move on to North Carolina. It looks like there are three likely new members of Congress. Mark Harris in the 8th district, Pat Harrigan in the 10th district, and State House Speaker Tim Moore in the 14th. A couple of runoffs still to come in the 6th and 13th districts, but I'll pause there. What was there one specific thing of all the North Carolina races that stood out to both of you?
Mark Harris, just very narrowly avoiding a runoff. This is the candidate who you might remember a few years ago. He won a general election in North Carolina that was never certified because of a ballot harvesting scheme that one of his consultants, I believe, pled guilty to ballot harvesting. And eventually a new election was ordered in which Mark Harris decided not to run. So it looks like he is now coming back to Congress about 6 years, I think, later. I might be a little off in my years there, but yeah, avoiding the runoff by 0.4 percentage points. So,
yeah. And yeah, that was, and for Republicans complaining about fraud, this was a case where a Republican consultant was, did, he was guilty of fraud. And that was there. All right. In Texas, a number of key Republican primaries, in the 12th district, there's a runoff between State Senator Craig Goldman and construction company owner John O'Shea. We talked about this a lot in the last episode with Abby. There's also a runoff Congressman Tony Gonzalez against Brendan Herrera. Jacob, why don't you talk about this race just for a second?
Tony Gonzalez represents this wide swath of territory in West Texas. He voted for a couple of pieces of legislation that have earned him the ire of the state party. One of them was the gun bill that was passed in the wake of the Uvalde shooting. Uvalde is in this district. This bill was negotiated by John Cornyn, the state's senior senator, a pretty conservative Republican. Tony Gonzalez voted for it. He was one of a handful of House Republicans who cast his vote for it. He also voted for that bill to codify gay marriage protections, and that earned him a censure from the state Republican Party and primary challengers. He had a couple of primary challengers. The one who ultimately finished in second and forced him into a runoff is a guy named Brendan Herrera, who's a YouTuber and firearms enthusiast, I think is the best way to think about it. He makes videos about guns. So he finished about 20 points behind Gonzalez, but it's never a good thing for an incumbent to be forced under 50%. This is going to be an interesting runoff to watch. I think there's some real danger for Gonzalez. And it's also, you know, it's a reminder that parties should be accounting for best and worst case scenarios, because if Brendan Herrera wins the primary, right, this is not a solidly Republican district. This is a Republican leaning district, but it's one that in the past has been highly competitive. And there's no reason to believe why with the right Democrat against the wrong Republican, it might remain competitive. The Democrats nominated a no-name candidate named Santos Limon. I guess he does have a name. But I think it was really interesting. I was thinking about this earlier. In that Senate race, the second place finisher in the Senate race against Allred is a state senator named Roland Gutierrez, who represents Uvalde, who also, which of course sits in this district. In a world where the party committees and the party apparatus was kind of perfectly calibrated, and you know the party bosses got to decide who went where and what the most efficient allocation of political resources was, I think Roland Gutierrez would be running for this House district instead of finishing with 16% in a statewide Senate primary. He would be, I would venture, an incredibly compelling candidate for House Democrats in this district if he had decided to go that route instead of losing to Colin Allred by 40 points. So a bit of a sliding doors moment for Democrats, maybe one that they will come back to if Brendan Herrera is the Republican nominee in a couple months.
And one more seat in Texas on the Republican primary side. Another likely new member of Congress, Brandon Gill, won that primary. That's to replace Congressman Michael Burgess. And then in California, this is the regular election in what was the Kevin McCarthy seat. The special election is still to come later this spring. But Vince Fong, the McCarthy preferred candidate, finished in first. It looks like he'll face a Republican in the general election, although the Democrat is not far behind in third place in a race that has not been officially called yet. There are also a handful of Democratic primaries that were critical in Democratic districts. In Texas, Congresswoman Lizzie Fletcher won renomination in a race that ended up getting some attention. In the 18th district, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee won renomination in the Houston area. And then in the 32nd district, State Rep Julie Johnson will be a member of Congress next year in what was the Colin Allred seat in the North Dallas suburbs. Mel, what stood out to you from those?
The Sheila Jackson Lee race, she had last year run for mayor of Houston, lost that race. And so she ended up coming back into this race, which already had another Democrat, a former intern of hers, Amanda Edwards, running. She had a very strong fundraising record, came in really looking like she might be able to push out her former boss. And ultimately, I think this kind of shows, even with a lot of money, it's really hard to oust a long-term incumbent like Sheila Jackson Lee, who just is well-known in that district and has been elected many, many times.
Yeah, exactly. And in California, a number of Democratic districts had key primaries. In the 16th district, the Anna Eshoo seat, that's going to be a Democrat versus a Democrat, but it's still uncalled. In the 29th district, Tony replacing Congressman Tony Cardenas, it looks like Luz Rivas will be the new member there. In the 30th district, this is the Adam Schiff seat, Laura Friedman is going to be the new member of Congress. And in the 31st district, this is to replace Congresswoman Grace Napolitano. Former Congressman Gil Cisneros is likely to be the next member returning to Congress from that district. Jacob, what stood out to you from those?
So in that 30th district, which is the old Adam Schiff seat, we really got a classic example of how the top two primary can influence the result here. This is a Democratic seat, but there is about 25 to 28% of the vote that votes Republican. And when you have 10 Democrats and two Republicans facing off against each other all on the same ballot, you can get into a situation where the 10 Democrats split the vote and one of the two Republicans sneaks into second place. That's exactly what happened here. State Assemblywoman Laura Friedman finished in first. We've got about three quarters of the vote counted. She's at just under 30% now. The second place finisher is a guy named Alex Balekian, who is a Republican. That race hasn't been called yet. Anthony Portantino, who's a Democratic state senator, is in third place, but it looks like Balekian will be in that general election and Laura Friedman will be the next member. The number of things that had to happen for this outcome is pretty astounding. The biggest item development may have been, and I pointed this out on Twitter when it happened, Alex Balekian, who is a physician, did not begin this race as a Republican. He began it as an independent and several months ago decided to change his registration or his party affiliation on the ballot from independent to Republican. And I said at that point, I said, this could make the difference because he's got an Armenian surname. This district has a significant Armenian population. And now he's going to be the best funded Republican in the race, even if he only gets 20%. That could make the difference between two Democrats winning the primary and a Democrat and a Republican. And lo and behold, got about 19%. And now this race is over. If it had been Friedman versus Portantino all the way to the general election, that would have been a very competitive, expensive LA race. It was
The most important to me that the lesson is that people should be following you and Mary Ellen on Twitter. That's what people need to be doing. But Jacob, I have to disagree with you. That was not the most important development of that race. It was how actor Ben Savage, what happened? I'm going to use one of your other tweets. What happened when Ben Savage from Boy Meets World, when Boy met voters, what happened?
Well, voters said no. Voters said no thanks. Ben Savage, of course, the former child actor, I guess adult actor as well. He was in the reboot. Ran an odd race for this district. A quixotic, I think, is the best word. Finished in seventh place with 4%, despite the fact that he probably got more national news coverage from launching his bid than any of these other candidates. This was always going to happen. He was not seen as a credible candidate by people on the ground, by other campaigns. And so it's unsurprising that he finished in seventh place. I believe that's the same position he got when he ran for a West Hollywood city council seat a couple years ago. So stick to acting? I don't know. I mean, I'm not one to tell anyone to run or not run for office, but clearly this is not his strong suit.
Well, fun fact, Nikki Haley only won one more state in the Republican presidential primary than Ben Savage did. So that's a fun fact people might not know. And finally, our Look What I Found segment, where we highlight something new that we found. It doesn't have to be politics. It could be sports. It could be food. It doesn't really matter. Jacob, what did you find?
So no exotic foods this time, Nathan. So
oh my God. If everyone hasn't listened to the last episode, please you go back and you can maybe watch that one on YouTube and see my facial reaction.
No, this one is much more traditional. I woke up this morning to a story in Politico unmasking the identity of, in my mind, one of the most interesting accounts on Twitter these days, an account called Ringvis, who is a parliamentarian who is a follow that is absolutely necessary if you're interested at all in how parliamentary procedure works, especially with all the craziness in the House these past couple months. They have been an invaluable resource. They're always on top of it with whatever precedent or historical item is most relevant to the news of the day. And they're anonymous, or they were until today when Gabe Fleischer, whose newsletter Wake Up to Politics is also really great, unmasked them as not a former Senate parliamentarian, as some people had guessed, or a longtime chief of staff, as other people had posited, but in fact, a 20-year-old Polish-British student living in the UK who decided a couple years ago that he wanted to learn about parliamentary procedure and is now kind of the expert on all of these minutiae and arcana of how Congress works. And he can't even buy a beer here in DC. His name is Casper Surdy. And it was just, I went back and forth between being delighted reading this article and feeling ancient this article about this 20-year-old who has become one of the most listened to figures among a small but very influential coterie of Washington machers over the last year or so.
Well, I'm going to still in Niels, I trust our colleague, roll call colleague Niels on Parliament, on that. I'm still going to go to Niels. I thought you were going to say that Cat Turd was unmasked from Twitter, but you went a different direction.
His identity has been public for a while. I mean, he was on Tucker Carlson.
Oh, well, there you go. That's how far, I guess that's how shows how much I watch Tucker Carlson. But Mel, what did you find?
I found something a little bit different. I was very excited today when I opened my Spotify app this morning that the new Ariana Grande album is out. And I think I am mostly excited because this is kicking off just a whole string of pop albums this spring that I'm very excited for and looking forward to driving across congressional districts throughout this year, having these as my soundtrack.
Well, we should have also had then our colleague Bradley Washer, who does most of our data analysis. I think he's excited about the release as well. He was tweeting about it last
night. So. I'll go to his Twitter and see all his thoughts.
I'm going to have to rely on both of you for the review. I don't know if I will be personally, if it'll be at the top of my list, but that's all right.
Maybe she's expanding to screamo. You never know.
Yeah, sure. Metal core. Yeah,
so far, none of that. I'll let you know when I've completed the album. We had to stop listening to join you guys.
That's good. Well, thank you for taking that, taking this time for us. And I found that I'm becoming a softie, apparently, and becoming very emotional. I've been on a number of airplanes recently, and I found myself watching this 3-episode documentary about Angel FC, the women's soccer team in LA that Natalie Portman, a bunch of women, are involved in starting. I don't know. I found it was great storytelling. I'm getting all worked up about this. I didn't even know this team existed 2 years ago. 2 weeks ago, and it was compelling. It was good. Or maybe it's just because I was on an airplane and needed something. But it was a fun watch. If any of you find yourself looking in that genre for things to do. And that's all the time we have. We talked about the impact of the State of the Union and Republican response on congressional races and dissected the key congressional primaries from Super Tuesday and also what things I'm watching on an airplane. Thank you for joining us. At Inside Elections, we provide nonpartisan analysis of congressional, presidential, and gubernatorial races. With a combination of reporting and data, we break down the key races and bring valuable context to complex elections. Go to insideelections.com to subscribe to the biweekly newsletter. We've got individual subscriptions as well as group packages that are tailor-made for association and corporate PACs. If you like this episode, please subscribe. Leave a rating, leave a comment, do all the things that are helpful to us. Click the thumbs up button if you're watching on YouTube. If you didn't like today's episode, please email Ben Savage. We also wanted to thank our producers, Alan Tazinski and Melissa Lenner of Pretty Easy Podcasts, and our associate producer, Conrad Tolosa. Please come back and join us again next time.